This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Do you drive a vehicle? Then you'll find autocorrect helpful, especially on Coach Charlie's Tip of the Week. Listen to our podcast with me, Coach Charlie Melton, on any podcasting platform or on the MPB Public Media app.
Welcome to In Legal Terms on MPB Think Radio, the show all about you and your rights. Our host is Professor Richard Gershon from the University of Mississippi School of Law. I'm Liz Gill. Professor Gershon, we're so glad that you're with us today.
Well, it's great to be here with you, Liz. And today I'm excited to welcome and introduce my colleague, Robert Duran. Professor Duran has joined our faculty as a visitor. It was going to be a one-year visit. He's so good. We asked him to stay another. And then recently, we've offered him to stay even longer than that because we really enjoyed having Bob with us. And so, Bob, good morning and welcome. And could you tell us a little bit about your background and your role at the law school?
Sure. Well, I'm a tax lawyer by training, turned tax law professor. I received my legal training in California, where I'm from originally, at Santa Clara, which is a small Jesuit school in Silicon Valley, and continued my studies at New York University. I'm a visitor, visiting professor here at Ole Miss Law School, and in my second year of the visit, where I teach federal income tax subjects. And so I'm very happy to be on the broadcast this morning. Look forward to a lot of good questions.
And I will say, I'll brag about Bob, that he has been a great member of our community. He's helped our students tremendously. And so we're glad to have him on board. And so, Bob, you know, you wanted to talk today about something that I think a lot of people don't know that much about, which is information returns that have to be filed with the Internal Revenue Service. We know we have to file our tax returns. But so I'm intrigued by this topic. Why is that of interest?
Well, it's sort of like, you know, why are potholes in the road of interest? Because they can damage your vehicle, they can hurt you in some ways. And these information returns are very similar. I got more interested in them when the penalties for failure to file these forms started getting very, very significant. And I, up until that point, I had assumed that the accountants had a handle on everything, and learned at that point that that's not necessarily the case. There are a lot of information returns of all kinds that that are obscure. People don't know about them, and again, the penalties for failure to file can be quite significant. And so that's why I got involved in helping some clients with relief from penalties, and I've just sort of taken an interest in it. I think it's important and derives, of course, from the basic structure of our income tax system, which is a self-assessment system, meaning that we as taxpayers, we are responsible for determining our own income tax liability and reporting that to the government, telling the government how much we owe. We do that on April 15 when we file our income tax returns. But the issue from the government's perspective is, well, that's fine, and we want you to do that, and we want you to pay what you say you owe, but how do we know that the information on that return is correct? And the way the government gets a head start on determining whether returns are correct is by collecting information from all different sources, and those are called information returns of various kinds. They're filed by different kinds of people, and then that information is used internally to determine, you know, whether the return information that you've provided is accurate, close, completely wrong, and then audits may follow, and all sorts of things may follow from that. But in any event, that that's my my interest in the subject, and I've been, you know, following along with the development of it. And I might add that the new frontier in information reporting is has to do with digital currencies and other digital assets. The audience may have observed on income tax returns for 2022, and of course for all future years, one of the most important questions, in fact, it's right below your name and your address, is a question about whether you've received or dealt with digital assets, digital currencies during the preceding tax year. And so it's important stuff. That's my interest in it.
Yeah.
In Money Talks, heard on MPB Think Radio at 9 a.m. on Tuesdays, immediately before In Legal Terms, we just talked about the importance of end-of-the-year financial review and learning where your money went and how to curb your spending or increase your investments. And I guess, and you know, we stumbled a little bit upon the record keeping for that. So this is record keeping is extremely important to the informational returns.
Oh, absolutely, and not just from the taxpayers. I mean, certainly from the taxpayers' perspective. But you know, one of the things that's true and observable about the information returns is that the obligation to supply information falls on everybody, not just the individual taxpayers, but employers, banks, financial institutions of all kinds, educational institutions like Ole Miss. There's information coming from all sources. Essentially, every U.S. citizen, resident, domestic entity of various kinds and organizations may have these requirements to supply information to the Internal Revenue Service. In fact, financial institutions around the world have obligations to supply information to the Internal Revenue Service each year. So record keeping is a key component to that, and everybody is responsible for keeping records so that they can accurately report information to the Internal Revenue Service.
And Bob, isn't that, I mean, a lot of that is we're really complex creatures, you know. We don't just, you know, if we just got a paycheck and our employer reported that and that was all we had, that'd be pretty easy to track. But you mentioned cyber currency. People have, whether they know it or not, they may have stock that has an international interest. You got people get divorced. People have, you know, things that the IRS wouldn't know about unless they report that information accurately. That's why I think they wouldn't be able to do their job without these information returns. And Liz and you and I were talking ahead of time that's why really, you know, properly funding the IRS will actually help to raise more revenue, help them do their job. But so what, now you mentioned the penalties. Talk a little bit about what those penalties would be just generally, and then we can look at some specific ones. But if I fail to file an information return?
Well, the penalties take various forms. Of course, there are both civil penalties and criminal penalties. I don't know a lot about the criminal penalties, so I'm going to leave those aside and let's just focus, and I'm going to focus on the civil penalties. The civil penalties take various forms. Of course, there are monetary penalties. These are, dollar amounts that are specified for failure to file certain information returns or to file them accurately. And the amount of the penalty varies by, you know, according to which form it is that is not filed or not filed correctly. But in addition to the monetary penalties, there are also other kinds of penalties that might be implicated. One is, you know, the statute of limitations on income tax returns could be extended by reason of failure to file information returns. Tax credits could be affected by failure to file information returns. The amount of other penalties, not just penalties for failure to file the returns, but the amount of penalties that follow accuracy-related penalties, for example. You've understated the amount of your income on your income tax return, and that's affected by an information return. Well, those penalties could be increased. So there are secondary penalties as well that that could be affected by incorrectly or failure to file information returns or to file them correctly or accurately. It's a complicated, or it can be a very complicated system of sanctions, let's say, that follow from filing forms that, frankly, a lot of people aren't even aware of.
Great. And it's great to have Bob here, Liz. It really is. And we appreciate it. And Bob, yeah, let's talk about, I think people are probably thinking, who actually then initiates filing of the information returns, and where do they go? So, you know, let's say I'm a partner in a partnership, or I'm in an LLC and I'm a member, or maybe I'm a beneficiary of a trust, and somebody who initiates that information return, and where does it go?
Well, in the case of the several entities that you just mentioned, partnerships, LLCs, and trusts, the information returns are actually filed by those and in the name of those entities themselves. They're filed with the Internal Revenue Service, and none of those entities, LLCs included, if treated as a partnership, actually pays income tax. So the information that's reported is information that's collected and by the entity, whether it's a partnership or a trust, as the case may be. It's reported to the Internal Revenue Service. And then each of the members or partners or beneficiaries may receive a statement from the partnership, LLC, or trust with that particular partner's share of information, income, gains, deductions, and so on and so forth. The partner then, or beneficiary, then uses that information to prepare his or her own income tax return, reporting all of the information and computing income tax liability based on that income, including that information for whichever year, whichever tax year is involved. And so the entity itself initiates the flow of information, and then it's picked up, as I said, by the partners, members, and beneficiaries, as the case may be, included in their own personal income tax returns.
So what if, I mean, I know, you know, we're talking about people here. So what if you know, a partnership or an LLC I know I'm a member of doesn't send me my information and doesn't send the return to the IRS? So I don't know what my share of that income is specifically to report. What do I do? I mean, could I be subject to penalties for that?
Very possibly. You know, I think that the you know, that person who's affected by non-reporting by the partnership or the whatever the entity is, and, you know, I guess we should add S corporations here, which function in a similar manner to partnerships. I think that the person, you in our example, would simply file your income tax return with the best information you have, understanding that if, as and when you receive the information from the entity, you'll have to file an amended return. But I think in order to gather the information for the amended return, you need to diligently follow through with the entity to try and collect the information that's needed. And that may involve, you know, exercising rights that one may have as a partner in a partnership under state law, to demand information or even to initiate an action against the partnership for that information, or the LLC or the S corp, as the case may be.
And you mentioned, I know we're talking civil penalties. I guess, you know, we're not going to get into criminal penalties much other than to say a criminal standard is a much, that would be someone who criminally and fraudulently did something. So you don't see a lot of criminal prosecutions, I imagine, in this. So most of these probably are civil. But let's say the entity just fails to file its information return, doesn't report the income of its partners. At what point do they come to you to try to help them get out of that situation and pay off those penalties?
I think at the point at which, usually when an audit has arisen, that's when all of this turns from the theoretical to the actual and real. And that's when professionals get involved and try to either collect the information that's missing and to file a properly amended income tax return or defend the taxpayer or both, right? I mean, I think that there is not in every single case, but in most cases, there is a reasonable cause exception for penalties, where the taxpayer can just explain, I didn't file this information for whatever the reason may be, lack of availability, failure of the partnership to provide the information, and so on. And so there is a way, a process for mitigating penalties, and that's I think where this would lead in the case that you're describing, where the entity itself just does not provide the information. But there is some, you have to be diligent about trying to get the information. This happens a lot, by the way, of course, with domestic partnerships and so forth, but it is also very common for those that have small investments in foreign mutual funds or foreign corporations and things where you're not in a position to demand anything, and you may not get the information on a timely basis. And it does present very difficult scenario for the taxpayer.
Well, you mentioned, foreign transactions. I think a lot of people say, well, this is a local Mississippi show. Why do foreign transactions matter? And we were talking before the show. I have one share of stock that was a pharmaceutical company that was an American pharmaceutical company that's now an Irish pharmaceutical company. So I have to get that information every year. Why are the international foreign transactions, foreign bank information, information returns important to people in Mississippi?
Well, for various reasons, as you mentioned. You may end up an inadvertent investor in a foreign corporation. Even through your mutual fund investments, there may be foreign securities and things that are held that might give rise to the payment of foreign taxes. And these are things that would flow through on your individual return. But it's not just investments. It also has to do with just family arrangements. There are a lot of people now who, by marriage or otherwise, have relatives outside the United States that may be making gifts. And there are many, even here at Ole Miss, there are a lot of students who come from other countries that are here and engaged in different kinds of transactions. They're receiving support from their families or from perhaps their governments and their home country. All of this is of interest, I think, to Mississippi residents. And let me just make one observation about the information returns that apply to the foreign or in the foreign context, and that is the information returns that are filed by U.S. persons, meaning U.S. businesses and other kinds of organizations, including U.S. persons, typically fall on the person that's paying. So when your bank pays interest on your deposit account, they file an information return with the amount of interest. When Charles Schwab is reporting dividends on your brokerage account, it's their responsibility and you get a form. But in the international context, there is nobody that the IRS can readily impose this obligation on, so it falls on the taxpayer, him or herself. And to make, to ensure that this information is reported, the penalties are quite high. And so why would a Mississippi resident be concerned? Perhaps most are not, but it's because of the, you know, our increasingly small world, the chances of getting either through employment or investment or marriage or movement of people from one place to the other, the chances of stumbling across one of these information returns is higher than you think.
And I've just noticed the husband always jokes about retiring and moving to Portugal or retiring and moving to Costa Rica. And it is surprising how small the world has gotten and how other countries, it's everybody might have some kind of exchange with other countries.
Liz mentioned going to Portugal, and I had an assistant who actually moved to Ecuador back in the early 2000s and had to deal with some of this stuff. And she asked me a few questions, but just imagine, you know, we have a space law program here at Ole Miss, and just think about when people start living on the moon and how complicated the tax issues get at that point as well, because they will be there. So these information returns aren't going anywhere. Bob, you and I were talking about cryptocurrency a little bit during the break, and that has to be really a difficult situation for the government, because that money's pretty easy to hide, you know, and so reporting is really important. How can these information returns even uncover that money that's there?
Yes, there are some kinds of transactions that would, you know, where the current rules would operate relatively easily. So, for example, if one's employer pays salaries or wages in Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency, that's reportable, and that would end up on a W-2 if it's an employee, or a 1099 if it's an outside, an independent contractor or something like that. So that can be reached relatively easily. And, you know, purchases of certain kinds of property, with Bitcoin. I know there was, I read that there was a sale of a house in Miami or something that was paid in Bitcoin. You know, a broker, an escrow agent in that transaction could report all of the proceeds of sale and so forth, even though it was paid in digital currency. So those kinds of transactions, I think, fit within the existing rules. The ones that don't fit so easily, are a challenge. And, you know, how is it that the Internal Revenue Service is going to implement rules that will enable information reporting and so on and so forth? It's very hard, because a lot of these, you know, by nature, a lot of these exchanges and so forth are decentralized, meaning that there is no responsible person. There is no broker. There is no dealer. There's nobody in charge of effecting transactions on the blockchain, for example. It's decentralized, and there are people who are at work proving the transactions so that they can go through. But no single person's responsible for making that happen. And so getting that kind of information has proven very difficult.
Well, all of the crypto
projects underway. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say all of the cryptocurrencies were designed outside of governments. They were designed to work outside of the rules. And until the government, you know, catches up with what's going on, it'll be outside. Like, you know, when people first started making their purchases over the internet and sales tax wasn't withheld, you were supposed to willfully and politely claim how much you had purchased online so that that could be accounted for. And, you know, with crypto, and until a government finds a way to actually get its piece of the pie, it will be, I suppose, just informational. I sort of always think tax people are not cheaters, because that's illegal, but you learn a set of rules and you have to learn to play within the set of rules and find out what's in the rule and what's not, and just go right up to it to see what you can get away with and still be legal. I guess that's in therein lines the definite line.
That's why
yeah,
people
and
like
I think
Bob.
The rule projects, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Bob, please.
Yeah, I was going to say there are rule projects underway in the government, but they're very difficult. I mean, ordinary people don't even understand what this is about. I mean, I find it very difficult and just to trace or to understand what the underlying process is for these blockchain transactions. It's complicated. The terminology is you know, foreign to say the least. And so I think from the point of view of the federal government, they've started with enforcement, and then they're going to work their way in, I think, to formalizing some of these rulemaking projects. But even classifying what it is has been a challenge. I mean, the Internal Revenue Service says that cryptocurrencies and other digital assets are property. The SEC says that some of these currencies are coins, or I'm sorry, are securities. The CFTC says they're commodities. And so they defy classification in many instances. And until all of that gets settled, you're not going to see the kind of rules that we see now in the Internal Revenue Code that deal with, let's just call it, the brick and mortar economy. But there have been some very high profile enforcement actions against those that have underreported income from, or, you know, from these cryptocurrency transactions. Of course, I think we're seeing a very high profile prosecution right now of Bankman-Fried, who was operating something of an exchange for cryptocurrencies. And I think so eventually the whole area will be disciplined, but that I think is going to take some time.
Yeah, it's almost, I think people lost a lot of money, you know, because in some ways I always wondered, other than maybe Bitcoin, which seems to have some at least real hard value somehow, but a lot of these cryptocurrencies seem to be, you know, nothing more than a gamble to some extent, just speculation. But so that's got to be hard to regulate from a tax point of view. Liz actually asked I'm gonna ask this question, Liz, because I think it's an interesting one too. It's about barter transactions. You know, before there was crypto, the way people tried to get around paying taxes was through barter transactions. So I do your plumbing for you, and you do a will for me exchange. How are those reported?
Well, if it's just the two of us, I think it probably, if we're on our honor to report those, the value of those exchanges on our income tax return. But if, you know, barter transactions that are happening on any scale are actually reportable by whoever's running the barter exchange. And I think there's, if I'm remembering correctly, I think there has to be 100 barter transactions per year or something like that, which would then make that bartering exchange or facilitator an information report. And that person would have to file There's a 1099. There's a whole series. The 1099 is a form that I think many people are familiar with because you get it from the bank, you get it from the state of Mississippi when you get a state tax refund. There's a series of 1099s. I think it's maybe 20 in the series. But in any event, one of them has to do with barter exchanges. And so those who run these exchanges are in the position of reporting the information, and they're required to do so unless there's so few exchanges per year that it's burdensome.
Well, I used to be part of a babysitting co-op, and we'd barter babysitting services. Gosh, if you had to monetize that, I don't think anything that was ever reported. But it's been over 7 years, so hopefully I'm in the clear for not reporting on that.
Bob, you know, I can't believe we're already in the last segment, so we're going to have to kind of talk quickly about some of the other information returns that are available. And, you know, one that people get every year if they're employed is something from their employer verifying that they have health insurance. Is that an informational return?
It is an informational return, and of course it is important to establish the coverage. I guess less important now than it was 10 years ago because of, penalties for failure to have coverage. Those were enforceable 10 years ago and not now. But it's this idea of coverage is still a bit of information that is necessary. There is a small penalty, I think, if you are not covered, if you don't have coverage for the entire year. But that's an example of an information return, yes.
And one that I think a lot of people may have had some connection with at some point is one that deals with charitable organizations and not-for-profits. What kind of information returns do they have to file? They're not taxable.
That's right. Well, exempt organizations are not subject to the income tax on their contributions and investment income and so forth, but nevertheless are required to file an annual information return, Form 990, for those who are interested in looking at the form itself. And it collects a lot of information about, the amounts contributed, whether they're from, public sources, information about larger donors, which is private, of course, not available for public inspection. And, programmatic expenditures and so on and so forth, who's involved and all the rest. And so there's a lot of information there. I think a lot of our audience is probably familiar with the little information receipt that's received when you make a charitable contribution. The charity itself is responsible for issuing you a receipt for donations of $250 or more, contemporaneous with your contribution. And that's another example of information that's supplied by the organization or an organization to somebody affiliated with it, in that case, a contributor.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if we think about it, there's kind of a trade-off. If you get tax-exempt status, there's certain promises you make about how you're going to use the contributions you get and your investments, et cetera. And the only way that the IRS can track that is through those information returns. Are those available publicly? Could I go look up an information return from a charitable organization in Mississippi or elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. That can be seen. The first four or five pages, I think, of the Form 990 are available for public inspection. Some of the schedules that are attached to that that have more private information are not publicly available from the government. The charity itself may disclose that information if you ask. But generally speaking, the list or the names and addresses of large donors and things like that are not public information, but the amount of total receipts and expenditures and so on, all of that is available for public inspection.
And in fact, we've had Secretary of State, both when it was Delbert Hosman and also Michael Watson on to talk about, you know, their role in charities in Mississippi. And those, they are available. So if you want to check out a charity you're giving to at the end of the year, you know, you can find out what that charity does and how they use their money. It's a, it's not a, not a bad thing to do. But the other thing I think that might affect a lot of people will be things like retirement distributions. Are there information returns in respect to retirement distribution?
Yes, there are. And, you know, the custodians or the administrators of these retirement plans and IRAs and 401ks and so forth, you know, keep track of things. They're supposed to report annually the amount of distributions, any taxes withheld, and so on and so forth. So it's not the retiree that filed that information. It's the administrators. But the amount of the distributions and so on and so forth will end up on an income tax return. And it's the taxpayer's obligation to pay any resulting income tax liability.
Yeah, and you mentioned, and you and I had the pleasure of meeting with some of the foreign athletes that are here at the university, and they're really impressive people. That they can, they're all you know, good students as well as coming from other countries, and English is not necessarily their first language, but you know, they also have to report to some extent income that they get from the United States. And there are all kinds of reporting requirements, and talk a little bit about the kind of information they need.
Sure. Well, for the student, you know, I guess there are several categories of people that are here at the university. For example, there are students and there are teachers and trainees and others. Let's focus on the students for a moment. Those who are receiving tuition, you know, scholarship assistance and so forth from the university, will get an information statement each year with the amount of their assistance. And they may have to file a non-resident income tax return to report some of that. There's generally speaking an exemption from for tuition payments, you know, scholarships that are used for tuition payments and fees and so on, but scholarship for room and board, for example, is a taxable income. And so that's the sort of thing that would be reportable, and work study and other things would end up on a foreign student's non-resident income tax return. I mean, fortunately, you know, the scholarship assistance that may be coming from the home country would not be subject to U.S. tax. But they would have to still report or disclose that information on their non-resident return, which, you know, opens up another can of worms having to do with income tax treaties that the United States has entered into with various countries around the world. These treaties will provide some relief or may provide relief in certain circumstances to students from a given country. All of that is, you know, figured into their non-resident returns, how much is taxable and how much tax they may owe or not owe in a given case.
It's complex, you know, it really is, when we think about, you know, taxes, and that's why people like you are important, and well, your important brother is too, obviously, but in terms of advice and you know, why this is an area of law that students are interested in.
Well, I don't think anybody. Go ahead, Professor Duren.
No, I was just going to say I agree that with the many waves of simplification that we've had over the year, the Internal Revenue Code has just gotten increasingly complex, and it's really beyond the reach of any one person, I think, to manage all of it. And so you see more specialization today than in the past.
Well, yeah, I think everybody, nobody wants to pay their taxes, but we love having health care. I see Dr. Buttress. We love having publicly supported media. We love having roads that we can drive on without potholes. Nobody likes to pay taxes, but they do go to some great causes. Thank you, Professor Robert Duren, for being on our show today. We appreciate you.
My pleasure.
That's going to wrap us up for this In Legal Terms. Our team consists of today's board engineer is Jermaine Flood, and Abram Nanny is our podcast producer. So for Professor Richard Gershon, who hosts from the University of Mississippi School of Law, I'm Liz Gill. Please join us next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Central for In Legal Terms on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.